Okay, so I should say this is like the fourth in my trilogy or something like that, right? So I'm actually wearing this slide. It's on my t-shirt, so we can refer back to it later. But this is one view based on the small subunit ribosomal RNA sequences of a universal tree of life. And I'm starting here to use this as a roadmap because it will guide you through the different types of species and their genetic anomalies that I'll describe today. So, let's see how focusable that is. Just a bitmap, after all. To give you a sense of perspective, you've probably seen versions of this already a few times, but basically plants, animals, and fungi are up here, which means to orient you, as it says on my t-shirt, you are probably here, somewhere in the animal kingdom. I'm going to be focusing most of the talk on genetic and genetic code diversity in ciliates, which fall in this group here called alveolates. Now, one comment is that the genetic diversity within that ensemble called the alveolates itself is really greater than, if not equal to at least, the combination of genetic diversity found within plants, animals, and fungi combined. So these early diverging eukaryotes, since it's the eukaryotic lineage here, possess essentially most of the genetic diversity known to eukaryotes. Yet what's mostly been studied have, of course, been those main representative taxa in plants, animals, and fungi, and a few dispersed representatives within those eukaryotic microbial world. So I won't say anything today in particular about Archaebacteria and Eubacteria, the other two domains of life. But of course, most of the questions up until today in this part have been leading up to what may have happened in events prior to the last common ancestor or the set ancestor of all of the tree of life shown on this slide. So I'll show you a version of that slide again later. So ciliates, I've mentioned them in passing a few times, especially particularly with respect to the fact that they have such non-standard genetic codes, and that will be the last part after break. But here's an example of the chief one that we work on in my lab, clearly not to scale. This is Stylonychia lemnae, and it would really be much less than a micron. Well, no, a few microns, but less than a millimeter across. Now, this is a slide a postdoc in my lab made for a very broad audience, which we probably have here. What are ciliates? Well, they are microbial eukaryotes, which means they have a nucleus, which is sort of one of the defining features of being a eukaryotic cell, and other aspects like a cell wall. But microbial, meaning mostly unicellular, although sometimes they can assemble to form a colonial-like structure. They show tremendous genetic diversity, as I'll show you. They all are unified by the characteristic that they have two nuclei, and I'll describe those in a moment. One's called a macronucleus and one's called a micronucleus. And here are just pictures of a variety of different ciliate species, including ones like Stentor that are sort of more trumpet-shaped, and others like Euplodes that are covered and coated with these numerous cilia that helps them move. So I mentioned that there was this larger ensemble of organisms called alveolates that is very deeply diverging just before those crown taxa of life, plants, animals, and fungi. And alveolates include three main lineages. They're ciliates, and then there are dinoflagellates like this one, which is one of the ones responsible for bioluminescence in the oceans. This is Nautilucus intens. And it also includes malarial parasites like Plasmodium. So ciliates and dinoflagellates and apicomplexans, such as Plasmodium and a few other parasitic protists like Tularia and Toxoplasma, together make up this kingdom. So it's very diverse, more deeply diverging than plants, animals, and fungi, and these three main lineages of protists. So there are, of course, many other protists that I won't have time to talk about today, which span about 2 billion years of evolutionary divergence. So this is, again, back to a slide now of Stylonychia, the one I'm going to focus mostly on with regard to its unusual genetic systems. And this is a picture of Stylonychia caught in the act of conjugating. And this is a cartoon image instead of what the lifestyle is approximately like for these general groups of ciliates. Now, a few general features. I've mentioned already that they're unified by the fact that all ciliates have two different kinds of nuclei. They don't necessarily have two nuclei. They can have a few of each. And I'll show you examples, in fact, where they have some hundreds of each. And here would be a micrograph illustrating this DNA staining of the macro and micronucleus, because each one is filled with DNA. A few aspects about the ciliate lifestyle shown here, this is its sexual lifestyle, is that you start off with a mating pair of ciliates, like the one I showed you in the previous slide, and you wind up with ciliates. So first of all, with regard to the evolution of sex, ciliates have truly invented and perfected sex without reproduction, because you start with two, you wind up with two. They've actually transformed their respective genetic material 50% each, but in order to actually make more of them, they have to reproduce through either mitotic or amitotic division. So during this process of conjugation, a series of events is triggered, which basically leads to meiosis of the micronucleus, which possesses the germline, and destruction of the old macronucleus, so it disintegrates, although we don't know if all the nucleic acids are thoroughly destroyed or might still be present later on. So then the new haploid-formed products of meiosis from the germline nucleus basically undergo fusion with respect to the fact that one of those haploid micronuclei can stay behind and be the stationary micronucleus, the other one migrates, the migratory micronucleus, and so basically one respectively crosses this kissing bridge between them so that they can ultimately fuse, giving rise to a newly formed diploid micronucleus, which itself undergoes another cell division or another nuclear division of mitosis, and then one of these two initially identical newly formed diploid micronuclei goes on to become the new macronucleus in this step from F to G. And this is what I'm going to mainly focus on because of the numbers of massive genome rearrangements that take place in forming the larger macronucleus. Yes?
What about the natural habitat? What's the name of the wild?
Pretty much everywhere, in soil, in fresh water, in salt water. So,
just normal.
Yes. And they're, another surprising feature about them is that there are very few that are pathogens. The only known one is ichthyophorus, which is a pathogen of fish. So if your children's goldfish die of ich, it was a ciliate that killed them, but they don't kill us. So, first to evolve cilia? No, that's a pretty universal feature of eukaryotes. And it's also what Lynn Margulis would refer to as an undulopodia. So back to this cartoon, which is now focusing on the differences between the genetics of the two nuclei. So I've mentioned that the micronucleus houses the germline of the cell, and it has germline chromosomes like these, organized in such a way that there are vast pools of non-coding DNA. As much as 98% of the genomes can in fact not code for proteins and be AT-rich non-coding sequences. And then there are islands of coding sequences within them. In addition, these islands of coding sequences aren't independent genes necessarily, but are often shards or pieces of genes dispersed over the germline micronucleus. And in this particular case, representing approximately one-third of the genes we know about in Stylonychia or Oxytricha, its relatives, the genes can actually be fragmented out of order. So here you have a case of a gene whose pieces are spread out in the order 1, 3, 5, 7, 6, 2, 4, and these need to reassemble into the proper linear orthodox order 1 through 7. So I should add in addition that there's expression of DNA only in the macronucleus primarily. There's basically no RNA formed to speak of from the micronucleus. It's just the archival nucleus. However, it's used every time it goes through sexual conjugation. The macronucleus, the bigger one, is the workhorse of the cell. Now you might ask, why is it larger if it has only the 2% of DNA that's actually encoding proteins? And it's larger because it amplifies each of those sequences approximately 1,000-fold. So it starts off by taking 2% or 2 to 5% of the DNA that's found in the archival nucleus and then amplifying it 1,000-fold. So the net effect is that it has a larger quantity of DNA within it, but at less sequence complexity. An analogy. In fact, the first time this was introduced into the literature, when David Prescott discovered this phenomenon at CU Boulder, he called them, in fact, introns and exons by analogy. But instead, because the splicing that I'm describing takes place at the DNA level, it would be incorrect to actually refer to them as introns and exons. But conceptually, you can indeed think of it as the same.
But then there aren't exons and introns in the macronucleus.
There are. So there's both DNA splicing and there can be a further level of RNA splicing. In fact, I'll add, you've heard a few times about the tetrahymena group 1 intron, and tetrahymena is also a ciliate, and in fact, it's the ribosomal RNA gene, the one used to make this t-shirt. which contains the self-splicing group 1 intron that Tom Cech discovered and received the Nobel Prize for.
And there's no correlation then between the splicing that occurs in the DNA level and the splicing that occurs in the RNA level?
No. In this organism, there's more splicing at the DNA level than the RNA level, so there's a smaller sampling of introns.
Where is that splicing
coming from? Where in the gene or where in the cell?
Where in the cell?
Well, probably in the macronucleus or nearby. Oh, where is this splicing place taking place? I was thinking of RNA splicing. There's a stage which is actually quite beautiful where the cell goes through macronuclear development. It takes about 48 hours in real time, during which time one of the two micronuclei that's going on to become the new macronucleus swells up. It actually amplifies to a much higher DNA content than you see in the final macronucleus. And so it sort of looks like a giant belly button or stomach in the middle of the cell. And then it shrinks back down. So it happens right in the center in a compartment. Yeah. So that particular archival nucleus that's going on, the newly formed micronucleus that's going on to become the macronucleus, swells up enormously.
Splicing?
DNA splicing happens during that swelling stage because that's when the germline nucleus is being converted into the macronucleus. And tons of events like these, like on the order of 20,000, genes have to be rearranged properly and then in addition amplified. So that's what's taking place during this 48-hour stage of development.
So I should imagine one
copy
being splicing
that amplified. Correct. We actually don't know very much about the proper timing of amplification, but there's sort of two bursts of amplification, one presumably before and one after the genes have been correctly rearranged. That's how it seems. Probably yes, but we're not really sure. There's some tetrahymen genetics that looks like rates of crossing over, but not much in these species.
When they are mixed like this in the micronucleus, do the genes get scrambled? Different genes, do they get scrambled?
Well, so this is what I'm referring to as scrambling, having the pieces out of order in the germline. Is that what you mean by scrambling? These are parts of genes. This is a gene.
No, let's say different genes. Parts of different genes.
Is there, in other words, admixture sort of between a gene A and a gene B? Not that we know of, but there's the opportunity for something like this to happen, for it to make to exploit its capacity for combinatorial synthesis of genes.
How conservative is the gene order or the segment order or whatever in the micronuclear DNA?
Not very. I'll show you some examples, but there can be a lot of fluctuations with respect to where these boundaries lie between coding and non-coding sequence.
It's also picked up the order, like here it's there, you know, with some other part of the DNA in another.
Well, when you say conserved, do you mean if we take relatives of the same species and look at the same gene?
Right.
Yeah, I'll show you some examples of that, and because it depends on the evolutionary timescale. If you look at deeply diverging relatives, then there's quite a lot of reorganization of the germline. If you look at close relatives, then maybe one has an additional piece with respect to the other, but a more modest level of variation.
How frequently is just DNA splicing strategy used in
eukaryotes, infrequently. It's analogous, but not homologous, presumably, to, say, VDJ rearrangements in the immune system, which, again, assemble genes together from respective pieces. It's quite unique, I would say, to ciliates, but making use of general properties of what we think is homologous recombination, or, in general, the ability to splice DNA molecules together. So, what I'm focusing on is, in fact, a particular property, not just in all ciliates, although all ciliates have this capacity to splice their genes at the DNA level, but this particular scrambling phenomenon that I'm going to focus mostly on for its sort of information content, this property is restricted, in fact, to a small group of ciliates. So it's not totally universal. We don't know what it's using. I should add that there are only two labs working on this system, and one is David Prescott's at Boulder, who discovered this phenomenon now some 10 years ago and is close to retiring, and my lab. So we don't have, for example, like handfuls of biochemists working on isolating the enzymes involved. and instead are taking a more genetic and genomic approach.
But there's no reason in principle this cannot happen at all, but at some limited scale.
Perhaps on a limited scale. I think BDJ rearrangement's the best case. There are other examples of genes being present in pieces in numerous taxa, but they're usually not put back together. So another example of how you can put genes back together if they get split, the left and the right half, for example, get dispersed over a chromosome, well, you can use in-team splicing to splice together the protein. You can use trans-splicing at the messenger RNA level to splice together back the messenger RNA before it gets translated, or you can use DNA rearrangements. So there are many avenues for putting pieces back together. And in the case of ribosomal RNA genes or some other functional RNA genes, the pieces of the genes can be dispersed, and they don't even have to be put back together again because the genes can act in trans, as long as there's a docking region of base complementarity so that one domain of the molecule can associate with the next. So ribosomal RNAs have probably evolved this way.
What's the size of the genome? How many genes?
The size of the micronuclear gene is, in these species, 2.5 times 10 to the ninth base pairs. It's approximately the same as ours, but they have only 5 times 10 to the seventh sequences in their macronucleus, uniquely present.
What's
1/50th of our own genome size, basically. So, yeah, about 5 times 10 to the 7th. So, for example, it's feasible to argue why one might want to tackle a genome project for the macronuclear DNA, because that contains all of the genes that get expressed into proteins, has tossed away all the non-coding DNA, and packaged it neatly in such a way, I'll add, that there's, in fact, a single gene per chromosome in these particular species. So it's sort of like, neatly, it has provided for us a prefabricated cDNA-like library with only the presence of a few extra introns. So it's very easy to argue why this would create a good EST type of genome project, because it has, in fact, thrown out that whole massive quantity of non-coding DNA. And thereby, it's effectively solved the so-called riddle or paradox of why do we have so much junk DNA in our genomes? Well, in fact, it's not needed at all for replication.
So when you say one gene per chromosome, there are, what, 5,000 genes?
Order of.
There are 1,000 copies of each in the macronucleus. That means there are, if you could be able to do this, 5 million chromosomes.
Right, but you could separate them and, for example, try to do, if you did shotgun sequencing, you would not have 5,000 copies of each one or something like that.
But I'm just imagining that the case of 5 million chromosomes.
Well, one way of thinking about it is Carl Woese thinks that these ciliate macronuclear genomes, these bags of genes that they are somewhat perhaps reminiscent of what the genome of, say, the Sen ancestor could have looked like. They don't have large linkage groups. It's not an ancestral trait. These ciliates have re-evolved a state of their somatic nucleus that might be reminiscent of a sort of ancestral state. But it's rather disorganized indeed. My sign first.
How faithful is this amplification? So if you have like 1,000 copies of order of 1,000 copies of chromosomes, does it create some variation?
There's some variation with respect to copy number in the messenger RNA. So for example, there are more copies of the ribosomal RNA genes.
Sequence variation.
Very little. And I only know this from one undergraduate's project who compared 50. And found almost no variation, not attributable to PCR error. Ed?
Is there any C-quad alternative splicing for these species?
Not that we know of yet, but it's too small a data set. So we need a larger project. So maybe I'll move on to a few more slides about this so we can just get past slide number 3. Okay, so what I've been showing you is a cartoon illustration, not an actual gene. But I want to show you a few examples of actual scrambled genes within ciliates and then go into a few details about how they can, in fact, disentangle such complex gene patterns. So, yes? Turning. Okay, the slide's a good audience. Yeah. Just need more water then. Okay, so this is an example of the gene encoding alpha telomere binding protein, which is found in Oxytricha nova, one of these types of Hypotrichia ciliates, as they're called. And here is a comparison of the germline map and the somatic map Okay, and so we have a gene order 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 13, 14 in the micronucleus. And then this is, of course, the correct linear order in the macronucleus, and telomeres are added at both the left and right ends. So this has this peculiar pattern of segregating odd segments that are referred to as MDSs instead of exons for macronuclear destined sequences. I'm trying to avoid jargon. And IESs for the internally eliminated segments in between. So this has the peculiar property that it has most of the odd pieces on one side of its germline gene and the even pieces on the other. So if you think about how to put together a gene such as this, well, when I give this kind of problem to my students as an explicit problem, the easiest way to solve it is with a spiral in two dimensions, although it could be something in three. And the notion here is that if you have pieces 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11 wrapped around each other in the center of a spiral, and then 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, and so on the periphery, then one can envisage a pattern of rearrangements allowing one to be spliced to 2, to 3, to 4, to 5, to 6, and so on, such that one series of splicing events would facilitate its adjacent neighbors. Now, no, it's one type of gene scrambling. The scrambled patterns could also be random, as in the case of some other genes like actin. And then I'll show you one compounded pattern in a few slides.
So the order can be different.
Yes. But there seems to be a propensity for patterned orders like this, which separate odd from even segments. And it might be because of a propensity, for example, for folding in the DNA that could facilitate unscrambling, but this we don't know. It's conjectural. So in biological reality, of course, one wouldn't have a very neat spiral like you saw in the previous slide, but in fact, instead would have rather a mess of wrapped genes, for example, because the lengths of the segments that have to be spliced to one another or have to be eliminated would have to essentially bulge out of the spiral, and certain segments themselves would have to, in fact, simply excise themselves. So I draw an analogy to Rube Goldberg inventions here, because it strikes me that these wacky gene rearrangements within the hypotrichous ciliates could very well be also viewed as an elaborate and ridiculous way to accomplish a more mundane task of constructing functional genes. And so I use this merely to remind you about how nature opportunistically has to work with the pieces it has and doesn't always have accessible to it a more convenient or streamlined way of actually constructing its genes or its proteins or gene sequences. Switch to the bigger pointer. Okay, so here's a genetic map. Again, macronucleus now shown on the top, micronucleus shown on the bottom, of a gene that we've worked on called DNA polymerase alpha. It's a ubiquitous protein. DNA polymerase alpha is present in everything from E. coli and Archaebacterium to ourselves. And yet within the ciliate Stylonychia micronuclear genome, and this stands over here for Stylonychia laminae, the species I showed you in the first organism slide, it has a very strange map where, first of all, the gene is dispersed over two loci. You can see that the green pieces wrap around and are linked to the blue pieces, but there's an additional locus that encodes 9 red segments. So you have a cluster of even MDSs or coding segments located on some dispersed region of the genome with respect to the rest of the gene sequences. You have a cluster of decreasing odd segments followed by a string of increasing even segments in one major locus that takes about 5 kilobases over one chromosome. We don't know, for example, if these two are even on the same chromosome, although we have some recombination data to suggest that they are. So they're just very, at least more than 5 kb apart from one another.
Do you
mean these small numbers?
Yeah.
These indicate the lengths of the coding regions and the lengths of the non-coding regions in between them.
In base pairs.
So, for example, this is not to scale because there's only 20 base pairs between piece 3 and piece 1, but I've drawn it for you in such a way to illustrate one conceptual model for how the genes can become rearranged, which is that a hairpin might take place or a fold between pieces 1 and 3, where in fact there's an inversion. These pieces in blue, 1 through 48, are actually located on the inverse orientation with respect to the pieces shown in green, 3 through 29. So in other words, if these are on Watson, then these are on Crick, if we consider the two strands of DNA differently. So one strategy for rearranging these genes might be then to envision again how if two correctly splices to three and then three to four, this will facilitate the next step, which would be splicing of four to five, and so on.
Is that the case? The ones in Watson go to Crick?
Yes. So it's a gene that has no particular strand asymmetry, whereas most of our genes have all of its coding segments or exons on the same strand. This one has them dispersed on both.
I think for instance, exon intron, that there are all these hidden Markov models that people develop to look for signals in the sequence. Are there sequence signals that indicate where these splicing sites are and how they're arranged?
We're interested in looking for something like that, but again, have limited data. From a data set of three genes that are scrambled. So we would love to know if there's a way to have the sequences, for example, just for macronuclear sequences, which we can generate easily, and to predict where the seams occur between, for example, pieces 29, 30, 30, 31, and so forth, in the same way that one can predict in cDNA sequences where an intron might lie.
So in other words, if there is a signal, it is not strong enough with the data that you have.
But there's a strong general AT richness, and I'll show you, in fact, some ways in which we can identify this in just a couple of slides. Yes, but only 11 genes have been surveyed for both the micronuclear and the macronuclear versions in these species. So it's a limited data set. It suggests that as much as 30% of the genome, or from 3 and 10, or a little bit less, might be actually fragmented in this complex scrambled pattern. But and it's another reason to argue at least a pilot-level genome project for some of these organisms. The other genes have typically some fragmentation in them, but, for example, piece 2 follows 1, 3 follows 2. They don't have scrambling in addition to fragmentation. Well, we'd like to do some things like this, but we're limited also by how much you can transform artificial DNA into these ciliates and have it then become expressed. So there are some labs that we're working with to do just that, or something like that. So a couple of further comments I want to make on this slide before going on. Those of you who like counting might notice that number 6 is missing. And number 6 is missing from the germline nucleus, yet it's always found within the somatic macronuclear version, because piece number 6, only 12 base pairs, must be located somewhere else within the genome. So it's not found in either what we refer to as the minor locus or the major locus. It's somewhere else, but in every round of reproduction that involves forming a new macronuclear version, it has the ability to find it again.
How long is it?
12 base pairs. So we're not going to go fishing the whole genome for those 12 base pairs, nor try to justify that one. This is why we need to do a genome sequence. That is a true tiny, tiny needle in a large haystack. Not necessarily, and I'll get into that now. So the black vertical lines, you'll notice, vary in thickness. And the black vertical lines illustrate the splice sites, or the seams, where piece, for example, 25 is stitched to 26 and then 26 to 27. These seams are essentially what we refer to as pointers, the sequences that are present generally at the end of piece N and repeated at the beginning of piece N plus 1, such that there should be approximately two copies of a pointer sequence in the germline version, and then one copy is retained in the somatic version. And this is where all the information lies in terms of directing the splicing. In addition, I'll add that there's a very long region of identity in 196 out of 199 base pairs between the ends of piece 29 and the ends of piece 30. This might today serve sort of as an anchor, allowing the small minor locus to dock to the major locus, but it probably also illustrates the place where this set of segments, or MDSs, broke off from the main body of the gene.
Thomas? All of these have overlaps.
Yeah, I think that's on this slide. Okay, so here's an illustration of what I mean by these pointers. What we have, for example, are sequences present at the end of piece 13, this 8-base motif, AAAA, TCAA, and then precisely repeated at the beginning of piece 14. There are some exceptions, though. In fact, this piece itself is present itself 6 times throughout the germline locus, which could create a problem. So again, remember, the prediction would be that a pointer to be both unique and sufficient for guiding and scrambling should be pressed exactly twice in the germline version. The other problem, though, is we have no idea how many times such a pointer would be present throughout the rest of the gene, throughout the rest of the genome. So we're looking at a very small sampling of approximately 6 to 8 kbs of sequence to analyze the redundancy or the copy number of these pointers over here. And of course, we expect that this would be amplified many, many fold across the whole genome. So it's probably some kind of local sequence alignment problem. And the structure that I've shown you can facilitate proper alignment, for example, of 2 next to 3 if 3 falls next to 4. And that's why we think that the DNA folding must be indeed important. Going into more detail on this, yes?
On the previous slide, was it all to scale? Because I noticed that the segments seem to line up very much.
Right, they lined up very much, and I pointed out that actually they're not to scale. But I'll show a comparison of lengths in a couple of slides. So if it were to scale, it would suggest that this piece can properly line up with this piece without any bulges. Instead, they might actually line up such that the pointers are aligned, but the DNA sequences themselves might loop out, for example, so that the sequences at its 5' and 3' ends can be in alignment with the sequence below. So, okay, there have been a few questions already about how to identify pointers ab initio. Like, if we had macronuclear sequences, could we use something like hidden Markov approaches to identify the pointers within them? And we're very interested in this kind of problem, and I would love your suggestions, or if you're interested in working on this. For example, what the colors in this slide indicate are classes of sequences that are preferred, or sort of families of sequences that are preferred in pointers, or that are, I should say, found at higher levels in pointers than would be expected on average. This is not a rigorous test because of, again, the small sample size, since we're looking at short words. But in general, there are sort of families of related sequences containing motifs, for example, like AAAA, TCAA, repeated in the context of pointer 13 to 14 and pointer 14 to 15. So this is a series, or the color coding patterns indicate what we view as a series of potentially preferred splice sites. And we'd like to look at these further to identify how many classes, if they really do fall into discrete classes, there are for preferred splice sites. And how can we use such information to predict where the splice sites also occur?
Is the idea behind that is the number of proteins that are serving as the pointing agent rather than DNA binding?
Well, it's probably both a combination of the DNA sequences associating with their partners, or with their repeats, and then proteins involved in recognition of these complexes. But again, I'll just go back and say we don't know anything about the enzymology of the proteins that are involved in splicing. And rather than taking the approach of growing up liters and liters and liters of ciliates in the cold room to isolate such proteins, one could also take the genomics approach of looking for homologs to recombination enzymes in other systems. So a few other comments about these classes of pointer sequences. The redundancy, again, now is shown on the right-hand column for the sequences that are capitalized. And then what you see, or I should say the sequences that are contiguous with respect to one another, which would be sort of the properly defined pointers, the repeat at the end of piece N at the beginning of piece N plus 1. But in a piece such as this one, where a large portion of what might be otherwise considered the repeat is found, again, in the context of another pointer, perhaps because of its preference for splicing at that site. If one looks at the local sequence alignment, one can find, for example, that upstream of these 3 bases, which differ at the end of piece 13, at the beginning of piece 14, there's another GAAG, which matches at the beginning of both. And so if you simply relax our definition of what we mean by a pointer, then one can find uniqueness in terms of the pointer sequence and its context throughout most but not all of these MDSs. And this is probably very helpful in terms of the reality of the system, that it can tolerate a few mismatches.
Before you remove this slide, I would like to comment. The dinucleotide composition of the sites is striking by having a high dominance of elements TA, CA, and TG, which are the most deformable steps in DNA. So that would be why the combination event's happening right there.
Oh, great. We can talk about that later. Mm-hmm.
Kinks.
Mm-hmm. And that will also become relevant to perhaps to one conjecture for why the ciliate genetic code is so promiscuous with regard to changing. Perhaps because these TA-rich sequences are preferred as splice sites, but also would otherwise occur as in the context of stop codons. I think, is Ederius here? No. There's somebody here who works on tetrahymena. In coding sequences, it's very different from non-coding sequences. And the pointers have an AT content which is more like that of non-coding sequences in the order of as high as 70-75% sometimes. Coding sequences is much lower. I'm not sure if it's more like 50 or 60, though. But yes, so just on the basis of AT content alone, one can begin to identify a sequence that's representative of a pointer from a coding region itself, or coding region proper. The pointer itself is incorporated into coding sequence, but often sort of is poisoned from adjacent non-coding sequence because of sequence filtration. Okay, so a couple other comments I did want to make is, first of all, I pointed out the fact that the global or the local context of these pointers makes them effectively unique, which is very useful in terms of reducing the effective copy number of many of these sequences down to 2, the expected value. Some sequences, though, still can't be reduced in their copy number, for example, below 4. And that's because the pointer between pieces 12 and 13 is in fact precisely repeated as the pointer again, or in the pointer between piece 31 and 32. So there's no additional way to take into account context upstream or downstream in that pointer, which would effectively improve the alignment. So this is probably one such case where the structural fold of the sequence is going to replace the need to have sequence accuracy guided exclusively by the base pairing. Or I should say sequence recognition. We don't know exactly if these sequences base pair. So there have been a few questions about the evolution of such sequences, and this is just a comparison of 3 different species. We've studied, for example, Stylonychia lemnes, map as shown here of DNA polymerase alpha, now just in a different color scheme, and compared it to David Prescott's information about the gene order in Oxytricha triphalix and Oxytricha nova. And I'll just add that we know less about the map order of the minor locus in these 2 other species. But in general, in these species, there's relatively good sequence conservation with respect to where the boundaries lie. But if we zoom in on, this is at one level of resolution. If we zoom in instead on particular regions of the gene, compare homologous MDSs that have become fragmented, then it illuminates a few properties in the evolution of these genes. So, for example, if we compare Oxytricha nova's MDS 10, so its coding segment 10, and shaded in purple are homologous coding segments 13, 14, and 15, what seems to have taken place in the evolution from the last common ancestor of these 2 Oxytrichid species is fragmentation of piece 10 such that a byte out of its center has essentially been taken out and translocated to the opposite strand in this folded model, or the folded context, such that there's been a direct exchange of coding for non-coding DNA. This makes a prediction that I'll follow up on in a moment, that the stretch of coding DNA found opposite a region of non-coding DNA should have a length correlation, particularly for small sizes. And we'll see that this is in fact the case. This is over here in P6 an example of where one MDS or coding region has become missing because P6 has given rise to homologous pieces 7, 8, and 9 in Oxytricha triphalix, where 8 is one of those missing MDSs. Here it's only 8 base pairs long, but again it's not found anywhere within the closed context of this gene. And then there's also simpler levels of fragmentation. Again, Oxytricha nova, or a common ancestor, appears to have given rise from piece 2 to pieces 2 plus 3 in Oxytricha triphalix, presumably by the insertion of some non-coding DNA somewhere in the middle of piece 2. So these are some general properties of how these genes can evolve over fairly short distances. What this slide refers to is this correlation I was referring to of the length of coding sequence against the juxtaposed length of non-coding sequences. And so the general observation is that for coding sequences of length less than or equal to about 30, there's a linear correspondence between the lengths of coding and non-coding DNA that are exchanged between them. However, there seems to be an overall preference, for example, or at least an occurrence of eliminated sequence or non-coding sequence length fairly short, such that as the length of the coding regions expands, the length of the non-coding regions still stays small. So this predicts, as these sequences might line up against one another, that the coding regions, which are longer, would bulge out, such that the pointers themselves could be found in alignment.
Laura, is there any sequence identity between when you see an IES that's split from one strand to strand's the wrong word, one side to the other of the spiral between two different species? Then you can sequence conservation maintained.
So I'm not quite sure what you're asking. So if 14 swaps, is the non-coding region, for example, homologous or similar to the coding region?
On, in Onova, which is on the opposite side of the
spiral. Ah, too rapid sequence evolution to really be able to address that right now. But in very, like in strains or very close relatives, one could. But because it, yeah, it precisely makes the prediction that whatever used to be here is now here. The problem is that what used to be here is just something which is 75% AT and hard to actually align, since there's no amino acid sequences encoding. I'll briefly actually back up and show you another way of thinking about this problem. And this will probably overpower the slides, so we're good. Which is that if you view it in one dimensions, this is essentially what you have. What you have is basically the entire sequence here of the major locus with boxes that are underlined indicating indicating pointers. The adjacent highlighted sequences that are not underlined indicate sequence context that probably facilitates correct alignment. And the global way of viewing this problem now in one dimensions instead of two, what I've been showing with the folded way of looking at the DNA, that's a two-dimensional view of the problem, just like the spiral was a two-dimensional way of simplifying diagrammatically how an odd, even dispersed pattern could be rearranged. But what you have to take view as taking place here, for example, would be that pointer sequences that are present in one of these colored boxes have to essentially find their corresponding partners. And I might have chosen a bad one because some of these, recall, will be on the minor locus. Such that basically there would be some sort of Turing-like head, okay, that's the unscrambling device, which would be reading this sequence and which would know, for example, when it finds this box over here, which is the pointer that has the sequence yellow on pale green, to jump to the sequence over here. And continuously, for example, you'll see that there's this sort of scattered way of viewing that there are representative sequences that may have, for example, their match found on the inverse strand of the sequence that you're seeing here. So, for example, you have four A's in a row that are in fact complementary to these four T's in a row, and the sequences adjacent are also complementary. So, while unscrambling this gene, something would have to know to jump from here to here, read the other strand, go here, read down here, read the other strand, and then continue carrying on this way, go from here all the way back here, a weaving process. This is why it makes a lot more energetic sense also to imagine it in two dimensions as bringing this portion of the gene, of the germline gene, in proximity to this portion of the germline gene so that there doesn't have to be as much hopping back and forth. Not a sequence-specific protein, but presumably a protein that recognizes the property of pointers in alignment. Yeah, it could be homologous recombination, but that's not merely DNA-driven.
Most of the recognition would be derived from the fact that it's double-stranded. Every time you have purple here and purple there, it's purple, anti-purple recognition in those segments. So what you need to do is to just make the double strand very loose and seek its partner. And it's not easy to imagine how
yeah.
it happens, but like in homologous recombination, as you said.
Right. However, it's a driven homologous recombination system. It's a very driven homologous recombination system. So homologous recombination nicely actually doesn't require energy. It might not require ATP input, but it probably is at least aided in terms of its accuracy by proteins. We would not hypothesize, though, instead that there was a specific protein recognizing each of these 47 junctures between the different pieces in each gene. That would be unwieldy. If it is, in fact, homologous recombination, which we don't know, then it might not require ATP production, ATP input, which would be a nice property of the system. As opposed to, well, there are many mechanisms that could generate a sequence where a pointer repeated twice would become stitched together. So it depends on how much input is required to make a cut here, join them together, and ligate it together. That could or could not require some ATP input. So the last thing I wanted to add here in this view graph was the reminder that, of course, what has to take place in stitching together the major and the minor locus is that when a sequence is reached for which there's no opposite pointer found within the major locus, then it has to, again, know to jump down here, read here, and jump back here, etc. So there has to be this ability or intrinsic recognition available between these different loci, such that the same mechanism that takes place locally can take place on a slightly more global scale. Okay, and so a more general model for how such genes can become scrambled over evolutionary time is also something we're very interested in. Why do genes exist with such scrambled gene rearrangements, and how did they come into being? So what I've been describing in terms of what we learn from the evolutionary comparison of closely related species, like Oxytricha, Nova, and Triphalix, can be extended to a more general model for how a gene can become scrambled over evolutionary time. If we start off with a canonically unscrambled or normal gene that has only, as we label it here, piece 1 associated with it, it has no fragmentation, then this pale green box, for example, could undergo, perhaps by chance, two spurious recombination events at these two X's that would give rise, sort of de novo, to a new scrambled pattern whereby this piece in green, if it exchanges evenly between a stretch of coding and a stretch of non-coding DNA located downstream from the end of the gene, this would produce a copy of piece 2, or a copy of the green piece in the middle, located in the inverse orientation with respect to the rest of the gene, and would produce a new scrambled pattern, 1-3-2, containing an inversion within it. So this is a simple way of sketching on paper how a gene that's initially non-scrambled can become scrambled in one fell swoop from two such recombination events. But the other idea is that once an inversion is found within this gene, this might in fact aid in bringing into proximity the two different stretches of the gene, the stretch that encodes protein sequence and the non-coding regions of the gene flanking it. And such proximity, especially if it's in the presence of a set of enzymes that are prone towards facilitating recombination between different strands, might increase the chance that stretches of DNA that initially are coding would become swapped with those that are non-coding, again, by pairs of recombinations taking place at such X's on the slide. So one model for how such genes can become scrambled over evolutionary time from non-scrambled ones would be attributed to pairs of spurious homologous recombination events, or something very closely like it. So what I show you here is a way of thinking about this entire gene, DNA polymerase alpha, that I've been focusing on. Its present gene map today looks almost like the one shown on the bottom, with the exception that this cluster of red MDSs, or coding sequences, is now located on another locus, and this one little sliver in yellow has been bitten out of the main gene itself and located somewhere else in the genome. But if we imagine an earlier stage in evolution, then this locus could have been joined to this locus, And this would be sort of a penultimate version of the modern form of the DNA polymerase alpha gene. Well, we can extrapolate further back to what may have been a very early version of this gene, perhaps earlier in ciliate evolution. The striped pattern that you see indicates the fate of various portions of this gene so that we can follow where different pieces of the genes wind up in evolutionary history. I'll also add that this is a non-deterministic way of thinking about the evolution of this gene. In fact, it doesn't matter at all if any of these steps happened in the order which is shown here. It's just for pedagogical purposes. The main gist of thinking about how this series of homologous recombination events would have given rise to the modern day version, or a penultimate version, of this DNA polymerase alpha gene is simply that pairs of these driven or non-driven homologous recombination types of events would have, over evolutionary time, accrued to the point where we see a pattern such as the one shown here fairly deterministically. So if we start off with a gene, for example, that has perhaps piece 1 followed by piece 2, which is a conservative estimate, and it doesn't really matter whether there's a stretch of non-coding DNA found at the end or not, but the reason I say this is conservative is that within all ciliate versions of DNA polymerase alpha that have been examined so far, even if they're not scrambled, they tend to have one non-scrambled IES at the 5' end. So what this is it means that it's sort of like having an intron at the 5' end of the gene. There's simply piece 1 followed by the rest of the gene, which here would be simply labeled piece 2. So recall that the stripes just are allowing us to follow where different pieces of the gene wind up in the more recent ancestor. Another reason that it's conservative to assume that there could have been some non-coding DNA here at the end, which might have allowed a bend in the DNA, for example, if this was a type of DNA sequence prone to bending, is that within the table of pointers that I showed you earlier, I won't get it out again, most of the pointers were on average length 10 to 12 nucleotides, but some pointers, especially particularly between non-scrambled IESs, for example, between piece 1 and 2, where piece 1's here, piece 2's here, that's not a complicated problem by comparison to the others. Oftentimes, these are separated by short pointers, and sometimes as short as a single TA dinucleotide, where there's a TA here and a TA here, which brings these two into proximity, again, with presumably other factors, since there are other TA dinucleotides found in the non-coding region. So this is the same type of DNA splicing, TA-driven splicing, found within all other ciliates, including the distant relatives like Paramecium and Tetrahymena. So the main idea is that this simpler TA-driven IES splicing event is probably ancestral and, more intriguingly, is potentially even homologous to a type of DNA transposition, which is today found in another ciliate species called Euplodes. So maybe one of the earliest events that gave rise to or triggered this capacity for gene rearrangements could have been, for example, the presence of a transposon or transposon-like or transposon-placed piece of DNA that later gets excised towards this left end of the gene. So remember that we're reading the gene from 5' end over here, if we consider it one strand, and it wraps all the way around, and here would be the end of the gene over here, and it's folded for simplicity, as you'll see. So the first step in, again, creating a scrambled gene from a non-scrambled gene could be to take this broad pattern, or any pattern for that matter, found within the main body of the gene, and allow an even exchange of coding for non-coding DNA that would be located upstream of the 5' end of the first exon, if you will, or the first coding stretch of the gene. And so this would give rise immediately to a scrambled pattern of piece 3 followed by 1, 2, 4. Is everybody with me there? Okay. And so if these rearrangements continue, and again the numbering shown in purple indicates the numbering from what we're calling the 5' end of the gene, the numbers that are shown in smaller font in black indicate the homologous regions to go with the striped patterns in the modern version of the Stylonychia gene, so not to get confused by those. If this fragmentation continues, then what you have is, in fact, a scattering that leads to a decreasing series of odd MDSs followed by an increasing series of even MDSs. 3, 5, 1, 2, 4, 6 would be the sort of pattern you'd observe in what we might consider the second generation of gene fragmentation. But as this continues, this would lead to an even longer decreasing series of odds, followed by an increasing series of evens, irrespective of where these boundaries themselves might actually lie. So this is a way of viewing, somewhat stochastically, how series of paired recombination events could give rise to modern versions of this gene. Yes?
I'm trying to plot in the histogram of the lengths of those floating segments, because this process would result in a very particular histogram of the, you know, probability distribution of the length of each floating segment.
Okay, well, what we have back here is one plot which has lengths of the coding segments down here, and what you're suggesting is frequencies of lengths, just to look at the distribution of them. Yeah, again, if you had a large amount of data, again, if the gene winds up being fragmented into only 48 pieces, which still seems like a lot, that you would have, would that be too small a sampling? Yes. The other thing to take into account, though, is that the process is also ongoing. It might explain this peculiar property that many of these densely scrambled genes sort of converge upon a similar number of MDSs. In this case, I've been talking about DNA polymerase alpha, which has, in the three species in which it's scrambled, 45, 48, and 51 pieces. And in another species in which it's fragmented, I'll show you, but not scrambled, it has 42 pieces. So it might explain why it reaches a capacity of a certain length minimum in terms of how scrambled it can be. But also recall that it's an ongoing process. So if we were to look I'm not sure which slide I actually do want to use to illustrate this. If we were to look at a slice of evolution, say a few hundred million years ago, then we might trap an intermediate at this stage where the distribution would be heavily biased towards sort of middle length MDSs. And in fact, it might be a more random distribution. What we're predicting is that it sort of does reach a saturation, which could correspond to about the minimum length that we see, which is approximately a turn of a helix.
Where did the pointers come from?
Well, we think they come from non-coding sequences, because...
But if you just have the swapping, where do the blank flanks? I assume the blank...
Yes, and every vertical black line is effectively a pointer. That's a good question. We don't know if the pointers come from spurious matches of a TA-rich sequence or something that contains one of those preferred motifs for splicing that happens to be at high enough frequency in non-coding sequences that it would have a chance match between coding and non-coding regions. Or more favorably, what might happen is that maybe there's actually a chance match in the non-coding sequences, which are all more homogeneous, between, say, a region here and a region here. And it might instead be recombination between the IESs that is instead swapping these pieces around. So there are many ways of thinking about it.
It's interesting, so. This idea that you have. I had a little bit about this. You have some very large regions that are not broken up. So it seems like if there's this process that occurs until saturation where you reach a minimum size, the question is, what is the probability of getting regions that are that large and unbroken, like the ones on the far right of your...
Right. Well, like here you have a long exactly. MDS, and these two are only separated by a non-scrambled IES, and you have another pair of long ones here.
Because that could give you an idea of exactly how saturated
yes.
is it, how random is it, or is there something?
Well, there are many factors you have to take into account, because there's also going to be natural selection on the protein sequence. DNA polymerase alpha being something universally present in all the three domains of life on my t-shirt requires that it's been a relatively conserved protein. In fact, it has seven very well conserved domains within it, which have been helpful in terms of designing PCR primers just to study the gene. So it might correlate with, for example, or there might be a correlation between levels of selection acting on the protein sequence and allowed or tolerable levels of scrambling or fragmentation in a gene sequence. So we're not sure of this, but... Well, no, the reason is that the regions that are highly fragmented are prone to more error because, one, you could have perhaps incorrect splicing at the junctions, and there's also higher rates of evolution at the pointer sequences because there's a floating of exchange between coding and non-coding sequences, because those pointers aren't fixed in space, okay, over evolutionary time. So what this means is that their positions where the pointers lie with respect to each other, in with respect to their homologs in, let's say, a short evolutionary time scale, could vary over a range of 20 to 40 base pairs. So if the positions of these boundaries fluctuates, then the sequences themselves have to vary. So if you shorten a pointer at one side by having a loss of base recognition, like if there used to be a T here and a T here, and this marks the beginning of a pointer, and one of those two mutates, so now you have a C here and a T here, and they can't recognize each other, that pointer is now one base shorter, but it might grow at the other end. So there's a high level of error in the pointers themselves, which might create a barrier to having high levels of fragmentation within conserved regions of proteins on which selection acts to conserve the protein sequence. So they're confounded levels of consideration.
And you think that mutation process is happening at a high enough rate that it's going to select against the fragmentation or that?
I think that's likely. No, again, because of limited data. I'm just starting to look at that.
But one question you could ask is does it work? Is there a relationship between the conservation of the amino acid level and fragmentation at the DNA level?
That's what we're conjecturing, but don't have enough data to look at robustly. So I'm just going to illustrate one more example, and then we'll take a break, which is...
You'd be able to do that because you know the fragmentation of the DNA level, and you could look at amount of conservation versus variation, not only in ciliates, but across all... If this is a protein that's found in all the species, various regions...
Well, it's analogous to the tools that Gilbert and others have used to look at intron distributions. Okay. But let me just go through two slides, and then we can take a break. So the point here is that if we could go back in evolutionary time, the question is, would we find one of these intermediates? And of course, without the ability to retrieve ciliate DNA from fossils, there's a very limited but still present record of ciliates preserved in amber, but not with their DNA, like in Jurassic Park. So instead, what one can do is look at other ciliate species that one can find in the wild and survey their DNA polymerase alpha gene organization to see then by inference what the last common ancestor would have looked like between a species like this one, Eurystyla, and those others I've been talking about. So a little more curious biology about the organism Eurystyla grandis is that what you see here by DNA staining is that it has hundreds of macronuclei, which are the short sort of sausage-shaped nuclei found scattered throughout the cell. It also has a smaller number, the order of 20, larger micronuclei. So what you have here are many, many macronuclei, which in fact fuse at amitotic cell division into one giant syncytial macronucleus. So the total DNA content in this cell might not be too different from that in others, except for the extra diploid micronuclear genomes. But it has instead these many-fold redundant macronuclear genomes. It's an interesting system. We know very little about its cell biology. In fact, that's just about all I know, I'm afraid. So not many labs are studying this, and it's hard to culture in the laboratory. So I don't know if each macronucleus, for example, is in fact identical. But one thing we do know about Eurystyla, again from inference from its small subunit ribosomal RNA sequence, like the one used to make this universal tree, among other sequences, is that it's closely related to these other Hypotrichus species and sort of falls in the middle of the cluster containing Stylonychia and Oxytricha that I've talked about exclusively so far in this talk, and another species of Hypotrichus ciliate called Euplodes, which uses so far only, as far as we know, only TA dinucleotide splicing. So we don't know of any examples of gene scrambling in Euplodes, and I've described a few in Stylonychia and Oxytricha. So the next question was clearly to ask what the gene looked like in Eurystyla. And then could we infer, for example, whether scrambling was introduced at this stage in evolution or earlier? And briefly, to give you the answer to this, what Wei Jen Cheng, a postdoc in my lab, found was that the micronuclear version of this gene was, in fact, highly fragmented. It has 41 or 42 pieces, depending on which allele one's studying, but they're all in the correct order. So this is a striking example of a gene which is highly and densely fragmented, but not scrambled at all. The pieces are all in the correct order. So if you look at the comparison of the map between Eurystyla grandis and that of Stylonychia limnae, where the color coding scheme indicates again that those red pieces are now found on the minor locus in Stylonychia, and the green ones are found on the opposite strand with respect to the coding strand of those pieces found in blue, then you can see that there's some regions where roughly the pattern is similar, potentially homologous, between the densely scrambled Stylonychia and the less scrambled, or the fragmented Eurostyla. But then there are other regions, for example, where there are these long, more slowly evolving regions in Stylonychia that are highly fragmented in Eurostyla. So this suggests that there are two forces acting, one which is continued fragmentation in the species lineage containing Eurostyla, and then, in addition, this swapping of segments between those that may have originally been fragmented in the last common ancestor of these species, giving rise to gene scrambling. So it supports essentially three views. One, which is that rearrangements or recombination events between non-coding regions can also give rise to gene scrambling, and that there's continued pressure, if you will, or a drive towards increased fragmentation in multiple lineages independently. Okay, so I think this is a good place for a break, and you can ask me. Where there'd be swapping. Right. Right. And something on a broader evolutionary timescale, which is different. Okay, so the exchange seems to happen on a recent timescale, like those examples of MDSs I showed you swapping between Oxytricha nova and Triphalix. On a deeper timescale, you don't see that because this entire lineage is unscrambled. We'd have to look at, if you compare scrambled lineages, you could see that happening. But if we're comparing something which is fragmented but not scrambled to something which is scrambled, we can see that some patterns are better conserved than others. So it's a different depth of looking at it. Okay, okay. Let's take a break here. Okay, so I'll just start by a few last comments on that gene rearrangement system, and then the rest is going to be on two other phenomena. One is that I've done a little modeling with a theoretical computer scientist at the University of Western Ontario, Leela Carey, whom some of you might or might not know. And one thing that we did was look at the computational ability of a system which is purely driven by gene recombination events. And what we did was show in an abstract model that the splicing events that are required for gene rearrangements could in fact be viewed as something that has Turing universal computing power. So it's intriguing to think about whether these gene rearrangements that I've described in the first half of the talk can be viewed as something equivalent to an electronic computer, just simply the ability to splice together pieces of DNA. You might recall is sort of reminiscent of the talk I gave on molecular computing and how Edelman used small segments of DNA to splice together a solution for a traveling salesman-like problem. So that's simply a comment, and if anybody wants more information or reprints on that, then please email me. And my website, again, I gave you the other day, has links to various information about this. So what I'm going to move to from here, as you can see by the pointer pointing up to these various groups of eukaryotes, conveniently, is a brief foray into slime molds and a description of some of the types of RNA editing that occur there. I probably have one slide or so of RNA editing, a different phenomenon that has been primarily studied in kinetoplastids, shown down here, a much earlier diverging group of eukaryotes. Bear in mind that the orders of these branching events early in eukaryotic evolution are controversial. And then I'll return to my favorite group of microorganisms, ciliates, back up here in the alveolates, and describe their anomalous genetic codes and how they can change. So first, a few of these species of slime molds that I'm going to describe. This is an example of one we've studied, Staminitis flavigenita, and its fruiting body is shown here. And within Staminitis, it has another type of gene rewriting mechanism. You might view these gene rearrangements I described in the first half as a rewrite system, a way to have something as an input and a different sequence as output. And in Staminitis, in this particular acellular slime mold, it's also called a myxomycete, there's a way of rewriting sequence information at the RNA level. And so what you have here is an RNA sequence from the mitochondrion of Staminitis, And every red box is an instance of an inserted C nucleotide. In green is an inserted U single nucleotide. And in yellow are inserted dinucleotides of different base composition. There also exists a different type of RNA editing in some species. I'll jump ahead to that in a moment then, which is base conversion. So this is an editing, a copying rewrite system, which can convert bases from C to U, as well as inserting bases. So the insertion, for example, of this C means that the DNA sequence in the mitochondrial genome of Staminitis would read here TTTAGTGG, etc. So that C is not encoded and is instead inserted at the level of RNA. The other additional discovery that Tamara Horton made when she was doing her PhD in my lab was that these edited messenger RNAs in Staminitis and in other acellular slime molds have poly-U tails on their messenger RNAs, which differs from the standard dogma in molecular biology of messenger RNAs all having poly-A tails. So that was another striking discovery. Why did we look at this problem? Because, we didn't discover the presence of RNA editing in slime molds. That's something that Dennis, I don't remember his last name right now. So another group had discovered many years earlier to our study in the early 90s. Okay. I'm not sure actually why they discovered it, but RNA editing is in general discovered by sequence comparisons between RNA sequences and DNA sequences, and the observation that the RNA sequence differs from the DNA sequence and that there's no version in the genome that correctly matches the RNA sequence. And that was initially discovered in kinetoplastids that I briefly pointed to, like trypanosomes and Leishmania.
Are some development?
Some developmental biologists are probably the ones that stumbled onto this, and they were studying the species called Physarum, which is sort of the C. elegans of, as far as a workhorse goes, of those people studying acellular slime molds. A lot of other people study Dictyostelium. So we essentially seized on this system as a very interesting one to study from an evolutionary perspective. And to do so, began looking at a variety of different acellular slime molds, including this one called Didymium, again with its fruiting body shown here. Another one called Arceria, these are its fruiting bodies. And a different one called Clastoderma. So you can see, again, morphologically, they're all really different. And if we look at a comparison, for example, of regions of these sequences, you can identify regions, for example, of C insertions indicated by the red boxes that are conserved in the three different species that have them. And then we can also identify less conservation of this fourth type of RNA editing event, which is CDU-based conversions, found in different places where you see a light blue box. And here's an example of one U insertion. So basically, you have four flavors of RNA editing within a single gene. This is a cytochrome oxidase 1 transcript from these acellular slime molds. And it's striking to have four ways of changing a sequence in a single transcript. So in trypanosomes, which have a glorious amount of RNA editing, it's all one single mechanism of U insertions and occasional deletions. And instead, there's this mixed bag of four different types of RNA editing in the acellular slime mold mitochondria. Yes? Well, good question. If I have a slide with an amino acid sequence alignment, and I don't, but I have it in my backpack, most of these sequence changes conserve the protein sequence. The insertions are absolutely essential, okay, because the insertions are there to conserve the reading frame. They usually occur in the third position, which is good because then the first two positions, if that forms the first two positions of the codon, can dictate the amino acid composition, and you can insert any base at the third position and for the most part, restore not only the open reading frame, but the intended meaning of that codon. The CDU base changes themselves are usually actually in first or second position, so they seem to be preserving meaning as opposed to just acting more randomly.
But do you believe that the floating part is always coming from the edited version or both edited and re-edited version or combination of these?
Protein is only coming from the edited version.
So everything is edited.
Yeah, most of this type of RNA editing is co-transcriptional, so it can't be translated. In the case of trypanosome RNA editing, the elegant way that it can make use of, or that it translates and ensures translation of only those sequences that are edited is that editing is directional. It starts at the 3' end and ends at the 5' end. The last thing to be created is the AUG start codon, or a non-canonical UUG start codon. So that neatly ensures in that system that these partially or pre-edited messenger RNAs won't be translated, so they're not translatable. Again, you might think there's the opportunity to have multiple coding sequences in the pre-edited and the edited version. In this system, that doesn't happen. But in our own genes, in the liver and in the brain, there are transcripts that have specific sites that are edited for the purpose of generating combinatorially diverse protein sequences. So there are many human protein sequences that have, let's say, 3 editing sites that lead to missense mutations, which can give you 2^3 or 8 different possible proteins for that glutamate receptor or serotonin receptor, but not here. So we see and I hate to use the term higher eukaryotes, but in metazoa, like our cells that have RNA editing as well, we see examples of it being exploited for its capacity for combinatorial diversity. But in protists, where perhaps RNA editing systems first emerged, it's much more baroque and more complex and more essential just for survival and for being able to create functional genes. Again, more reminiscent of how genes could be created.
Is there any appreciable fluctuation of non-edited RNA? Transcribed non-edited?
In trypanosomes, yes. In these species, because no function that's known for it. And in these species, no, because it's co-transcriptional. So, okay, quick question. And as far as I know, I mean, there might be more examples, like from looking at the transcriptome beyond the human genome, because, of course, you won't identify RNA editing unless you bother to look at a messenger RNA or cDNA sequence. With the proteins that we know of are in our liver, apolipoprotein B, where it affects cholesterol metabolism. And so there's a single site CDU-based conversion, which creates a stop codon in the apolipoprotein messenger RNA, and the truncated version of that protein is better able to take cholesterol out of the bloodstream and put it in the liver. That's not combinatorial diversity, although not very combinatorial, but you still have 2 versions of the protein. The combinatorial diversity used by RNA editing is in the brain, in serotonin and glutamate receptors. Yeah. Yeah. You must be editing right now. Okay. Okay, so I want to say something briefly about the evolutionary history of RNA editing within slime molds. It's something we've examined in other systems, and there are so many interesting questions about it. We won't have time to touch on many here. One comment I'll make, though, is that I've described 4 different RNA editing events that happen in a single gene in this lineage, and yet they all seem to have a different evolutionary history. If we look at a phylogenetic distribution of the different types of RNA editing, color-coded to indicate U insertions, C insertions, dinucleotide insertions, and CDU-based conversions. And the phylogenetic distribution or character mapping of RNA editing is consistent with the origin of U insertional editing first, and then the acquisition of C insertional editing that is probably derived from or homologous to the U insertional mechanism. Then there appears to be the acquisition of dinucleotide insertional editing, perhaps derived from the combination of C and U insertional editing mechanisms. And then there's a more complicated evolutionary history of the CDU RNA editing that converts one base to another, perhaps because this is the easiest one also to lose. You lose the requirement for CDU-based conversion by a single C to T transition in the DNA sequence, whereas the loss of an insertional editing mechanism is more difficult because you have to have insertion of a base as a point mutation in DNA sequence. So there are 2 ways of viewing the CDU RNA editing evolution, which could be that it was independently acquired in 2 lineages, or, as I would favor it, acquired perhaps early with the onset of other types of RNA editing independent mechanisms, and then lost, at least in this gene, in those 2 lineages that have no cases of CDU editing, probably just because of the transitions in the DNA sequence. What do you mean, here?
No, look at right. Up, there. No, look it down, there. That would seem more parsimonious.
Just because this portion of the tree is not resolved. So this is a trifurcation. This is not a branching order that says that this cluster and this is more closely related than this group is to this. Okay.
I just wondered if that's where you put the C. it seems parsimonious to do it that way as well for you.
Well, this implies we think that this would be, for example, a monophyletic assemblage because they all have C insertional editing. But on the tree itself, the key point is simply that we don't know which of these diverged first and which is more closely related to this trifurcation. Just ambiguity in the tree topology. So I'm going to segue from RNA editing back to the genetic code by one illustrating example, which is I've mentioned just briefly a little bits about RNA editing and trypanosomes. Well, trypanosomes are famous for the U-insertional and deletional RNA editing mechanism in their mitochondrial genomes, but they also have this capacity for CDU-based conversional editing. And where they exploit it is, in fact, in regulating the usage of their genetic code, because trypanosome mitochondria don't have any encoded tRNAs. All of their tRNAs are imported from the nucleus, but the genetic codes differ in the mitochondria versus the nucleus. So very conveniently, in the mitochondria, they have an RNA editing mechanism which converts a C to a U in the anticodon of the tryptophan tRNA such that it has the capacity to now recognize UGA as well as UGG by a C to U mutation at the first position of the anticodon. So there's a nice illustration of the use of RNA editing, in fact, to interface back with one of our favorite problems, studying the genetic code. And that's work from Larry Simpson's lab at UCLA, the discovery of a CDU editing mechanism in a tRNA to facilitate the usage of two genetic codes by the same set of tRNAs in different parts of a cell. So many questions came up yesterday in the discussion about genetic code evolution with regard to where alternative genetic codes are found in nature. And this complex slide, which is derived from our review in Nature Reviews Genetics, that's on my student Rob Knight's webpage, this illustrates the depth of diversity of mitochondrial genetic codes. As is well known, mitochondria are very prone to changing, and the actual types of changes are listed on the bottom, and I'll show them summarized on the next slide. In nuclear genetic codes, though, we see much less evolution, with rare exceptions. For example, firmicutes like mycoplasma and spiroplasma that I mentioned yesterday are the only bacteria known to have non-standard genetic codes. Within the protists, though, again, those lineages highlighted in the diversity on my t-shirt and on the first slide I showed you, ciliates as well as diplomonads, such as organisms related to but not exactly Giardia, and hypothetically very early diverging eukaryotes, they use some non-standard genetic codes, but they happen to use some of the same non-standard genetic codes that are also found in ciliates and other lineages, and those are the codes that reassign UAR, normally a stop codon, to glutamine. So this is a slide I was squinting at when I think Doran asked yesterday how many changes in the genetic code do we know about that have taken place. And here they're all summarized. And what this illustrates is that those changes in blue are changes that have occurred only in the mitochondria. The types of changes, for example, these CU codons from encoding leucine to encoding threonine are indicated as having happened once here in evolution. But those changes that have happened in both mitochondria and nuclear genomes are shown in green, and the column on the right indicates the meanings of the changes that have occurred in nuclear genomes. So one observation that emerges immediately is that no changes have occurred in nuclear genomes that have not also occurred in mitochondrial genomes. We can see, in addition, that there's certain types of changes in the genetic code, for example, the change of UAR stop to glutamine, that have occurred many times in nuclear codes. Themselves, that particular meaning has not occurred in mitochondrial codes, but those codons have changed in both mitochondrial and nuclear lineages. And then there are other various changes throughout the genetic code table that themselves also do reoccur. So there's some striking observations about recurrence telling us something about the evolvability or the ability of these various components of the translation apparatus to change. And that's important in constructing any model for how genetic codes do and probably did change. So if one wanted to know, for example, how many changes are there throughout the genetic code table, then you would have to simply sum up all the numbers and treat each other column as a 1 and I squintingly decided that it was approximately the order of 20 yesterday. These question marks indicate that there are certain lineages, however, that don't use particular codons, and so in that case we don't know what their meaning is, if any. So I'm going to focus, though, on these changes having to do with termination. Each change in blue occurs in mitochondrion. For example, this lysine to asparagine change occurs in two independent lineages, indicated by the two. And green is both.
So my statement is right. Every color change occurs in mitochondria.
Yes, with the exception that sometimes every codon which changes in the nucleus has also changed in a mitochondrial genome, but not necessarily to the same meaning.
So the stop codons. So stop codons could not mean stop codons.
That's right.
Stop codons. So is it that you just never get loss of all stop codons, or?
Well, you certainly never get loss of all stop codons, but of the three.
You change to a stop codon unless maybe the question mark.
Unless the question marks are read as stop. What I'm going to focus on, though, are mechanisms for interconversion between sense and stop codons in the conversion of stop to glutamine in some ciliates, which includes, for example, to both tetrahymena and oxytricha, and it's also found even in diplomonads and in mycoplasmas. That same code is very common throughout the whole domain of life, all domains of life. And I'm also going to focus on the types of changes that involve UGA from stop to tryptophan or to cysteine, something which is ciliate-specific in euploides. So basically, we're focusing on those changes that happen the most throughout all of what is known about the evolution of life and occur primarily, in fact, in ciliates. So first of all, one thing that we did was a pretty straightforward data mining experiment, which is that a research assistant, Kathy Losipone, in my lab, downloaded all of the protein coding sequences for ciliates that did not have well-characterized genetic codes, first to simply see if the annotation in the literature was correct as to what genetic codes these species were using, and then to look at sequence alignments of the predicted protein sequences derived from the ciliate sequences for species such as Colpoda that weren't well-characterized. We didn't have to do this for Tetrahymena and others for which we knew very well based on a lot of protein coding sequences which genetic code they use. But we translated using the standard genetic code all the protein sequences, protein coding sequences that we downloaded for the ensemble of other ciliates, and then scored how many times, for example, in-frame stop codons occurred, in particular at sites of conserved amino acids in the alignment. So here's an example, for instance, of UGA occurring at the site of a conserved tryptophan in a sequence encoding a cyclin protein. And up here you have sequences, again, illustrating cases of the usage of UGA and this time in another ciliate, blepharisma, at the site of a conserved tryptophan. These are just illustrations. There are many more examples of this. And this is how one can score relatively easily whether the stop codons, either UGA or UAA or UAG, have been reassigned to an amino acid. If we find the occurrence of in-frame stop codons at positions that don't correlate with amino acid conservation, then it's not very helpful at all. But it still tells us that there may have been reassignment to that stop codon, or there could be instead translational ambiguity. And so green here indicates better conserved regions of the alignment. And so these are particular regions that allow us to infer with reasonable, but not absolute certainty, that it's most likely that UGA in both lineages corresponding to Colpoda and blepharisma has probably been reassigned to encode tryptophan instead of encoding stop, which is a common change in the genetic code. The database would indicate silly things like it used a blepharisma type of genetic code, and in fact there's been something labeled that for a while, or it simply thought it used the standard genetic code, but this might be a sequencing error. So it simply was not, it was poorly annotated for most ciliate sequences for which there were as many as 50 sequences, let's say, in the database, and as few as 1 to 3. So if we look at the different genetic codes that we could now infer happened in different species and place them on a character mapping phylogenetic tree, this is what we're left with. And the tree is derived from a consensus of trees available in the literature for these different ciliate species, so we didn't have to create them ourselves. And it's based on a composite of large and small subunit ribosomal RNA sequences and some protein sequences. And the color coding scheme illustrates the different genetic codes that these different lineages use. So most often in ciliates, in fact, we see the UAR for glutamine code, which is labeled number 1 by the red coding box. Then there are two alternative genetic codes besides the standard code shown in white, which is the use of UGA as cysteine found only in Euploides, and it's called by GenBank the Euploides genetic code. And there's also UGA for tryptophan, which we observed or discovered in Colpoda and Blepharisma in two species that were otherwise annotated in GenBank as using the standard genetic code. Now, a comment also is worthwhile here, which is that we were scoring most easily changes that were between sense and stop. And it's much more subtle to observe changes in the genetic code that are one amino acid to another. That would be, on the other hand, another place where I would invite tools to infer, for example, on the basis of amino acid sequence alignment. If you saw, for example, that leucine was found at the position of an absolutely strictly conserved isoleucine in everything else, would you believe that that was a change in the genetic code if it always happened, or would you think it's just a conservative amino acid substitution? So there might be an observer bias here in our ability to even identify the variant genetic codes that occur in ciliates or in other regions of the tree of life, which is simply that we're limited in our capacity to observe and to draw inferences. And this one, changes between stop and sense, stands out a lot more like a sore thumb than changes that might be much more subtle in genetic code. Yes, and so it would be wonderful if somebody were interested in constructing tools like this to automate probing of the literature like that, or probing of GenBank.
But doesn't that have to be an intermediate state anyway? In other words, it's hard to imagine that I make this change in the genetic code as well as and that all of the DNA then automatically adjusts to it.
Right, and the other idea too is that it asks, how do genetic codes change? And traditionally, there's been acceptance of one model, the codon capture hypothesis from Jukes, that a codon goes out of favor, much like a loss of a fashion trend, and then becomes popularized again with a new meaning associated with it. I use the analogy for my students of bell bottoms. And that might happen in some instances. There's one documented case in a mitochondrial genome. But for the most part, it doesn't actually hold up, and it seems to be more common, for example, that translational ambiguity is a stage via which genetic codes have to transition through in order to emerge as a new codon. Ambiguity would mean that UGA is sometimes stop and sometimes tryptophan, and that there's a regulation available. And one can argue that because we use selenocysteine ourselves at occasional UGA codons, that our own genetic codes are in fact translationally ambiguous and use RNA structures, in fact, of the messenger RNA to regulate whether a UGA really means stop or whether it sometimes instead should be read as a selenocysteine.
So the Jukes model, I'm trying to imagine how you would get data to show that that was not what was happening.
Well, in the interest of time, I'll just say that a student in my lab, Rob Knight, has a paper on that in what's called actually the Jukes issue of the Journal of Molecular Evolution that is either out now or about to come out. Basically, the simple idea is that if you look at the distribution of all mitochondrial genomes as a model system, because they change in the genetic code and because there are many fully sequenced mitochondrial genomes, then you can predict, because the mitochondrial gene composition is typically high AT, that certain codons, especially those GC-rich codons, are more prone to disappearance in mitochondrial genomes. And that would predict which codons should be the ones to change in mitochondrial genomes. And if you compare the distribution of codons, as in one of those earlier slides, that change in mitochondria against codon disappearance, as driven by mutational pressures and mutational biases, they don't match at all. So that's the evidence in favor of that in JME. Okay, so another comment here is that one reviewer, for example, for Current Biology suggested, aha, if we look at this tree, it's clear that the ancestral ciliate species probably used the red genetic code, UAR for glutamine, because we see that occurring many more times it's more parsimonious to argue that, in fact, the standard code is a reversal of this non-standard code UAR for glutamine. But we argued back, reasonably so, that it's less likely that this could, in fact, happen, because that would require an orthogonal change. For example, if the code 1 occurred in the ancestral lineage here to these hypotrichous ciliates that we've been talking about, Stylonychia, Oxytricha, and Urostyla, and the new code, which reassigns UGA to cysteine, emerged in a UARS glutamine background, well, this is actually, that would require a completely orthogonal change of the usage of one of the three stop codons to the usage of the other two possible stop codons. And so we argue that it's actually much more plausible to imagine that such a stage in evolution in the early lineage of ciliates probably grew out of the standard code, and then certain lineages opted instead to reassign, in this case, UAR to glutamine, or in this case, UGA to cysteine. Now, I'll return, if there's time in the discussion just at the very end, to how these particular changes might be affected or influenced by gene unscrambling, as I mentioned. So the protein that's in question that we've been focusing on with regard to changes underlying the rewiring of these ciliates as to why they would opt to switch from one genetic code to another lies in this one protein called ERF1 for eukaryotic release factor 1. And here's the crystal structure from Song et al. That was published in Cell last year that sparked our interest and a lot of other people's interest in this protein. And there are many interesting features about this protein. So although it's not necessarily clear by the way the protein structure here is drawn in this representation with comparison with the tRNA, this protein ERF1 is accepted as belonging to one of a class of intriguingly tRNA-mimicking proteins. Okay, so this protein structure here in a three-dimensional context, here's another example, is essentially a reasonable mimic of a tRNA. Now what you're seeing here on the right is the first example of such a well-documented tRNA mimic, which is, in this case, elongation factor G, another protein involved in translation, shown next to the crystal structure of elongation factor TU, which is smaller, complexed with phenylalanine tRNA, shown in red. So this domain of elongation factor G, shown in red, itself is also an accurate tRNA mimic, as is also shown here. So here you have the protein, and here you have a smaller protein complexed with a tRNA, and those two essentially are treated very similarly, though not identically, by the ribosome. And it makes a lot of sense that many proteins that are, in fact, catalysts of events like translocation or termination of translation in the ribosome should look like a tRNA because they have to bind to the same pockets of the ribosome that tRNAs are otherwise interacting with. And so one plausible mechanism, for example, for translocation on the ribosome by the elongation factor G shown here is that it displaces the pocket which is formerly occupied by tRNA, allowing a footprint or an imprint now to create a space where the next tRNA can displace it because it binds even better. And there's also a GDP ratchet taking place there. So tRNA mimics, I think, are very important, or going to emerge as very important in understanding the evolution of the role of proteins in translation. And it's all the more supportive to me of an RNA world era where translation could have been entirely mediated by RNAs instead of proteins, because these are examples of proteins that mimic tRNAs in order to perform roles like them. It suggests that, in fact, they probably took over the roles of their precursors in an evolutionary sense that may have, in fact, also been tRNA-derived molecules.
And not vice versa.
Well, it's striking to me that translation is clearly well-dependent on the tRNAs, and that such molecules, one would have to, for example, generate in the laboratory a tRNA variant that could suffice and play the role of a release factor or of an elongation factor or something else in translation.
It's interesting, though, because if you have this protein mimic of the tRNA, that's evidence of the RNA world. And if it were all done by RNA, that would be evidence of an RNA world.
Yes.
So it seems like one of these unfalsifiable hypotheses.
Well, I would also say it sets up the stage for an avenue for exploration, which is that if one could actually date by phylogenetic analysis the order in which these, the age of these different proteins, which ones are derived from others. Presumably many of them are homologs in evolution, that is many of the tRNA mimics. Then that might tell us also more about the timeline for the origin of events introducing proteins into the roles, their roles in translation. Another amusing comment I'll simply say, which is that when the crystal structure of tRNA was solved about 67, Crick's remark was that it looked like, aha, nature's attempt to make RNA perform the role of a protein. And I would say, in fact, it's precisely the other way around, that these comparative structures between release factors and tRNAs reveal instead that many such proteins, these tRNA mimics, are nature's attempt to make proteins perform the role of an RNA. Depends indeed on how you view it. So the part I'm going to focus on, however, particularly in the release factors in ciliates, is this domain 1, which is the region that is thought to mimic the anticodon loop of the tRNA, particularly because, of course, those anticodon bases interact with the codons, and somehow the release factor must perform a role slightly more difficult than a tRNA, which is at least in those organisms using the standard code, recognize three different stop codons, UAA, UAG, and UGA, that differ at the second position, and no tRNA does something like that. I'll also add that there are two classes of release factors in bacteria, but in archaea and eukaryotes, there's just one performing that more universal role. They release the nascent peptide during translation, so they recognize a stop codon as stop and terminate translation. Had there been another sense codon, yes. Had there been another sense codon, and then they bind slightly differently to, however this works mechanistically, jostle the nascent peptide out of the ribosome. So I don't know the mechanism of via which ERF1 acts, but having that crystal structure helps the groups who are studying its mechanism understand that. In particular, there are certain parts of the release factors, those proteins that interact with the ribosome, again analogously to the way, for example, the CCA acceptor stem.
Maybe it would just be selective control of the tRNA, which would be called the terminator
tRNA.
Or is it not? Is there any case?
There's no known case, but that's what I'm suggesting somebody could construct in the laboratory, a tRNA that could supplant the role of a release factor. Yes. That would seem to be a reasonable experiment. There are other aspects, for example, of this release factor that mimic essential parts of the tRNA. So they have a universally conserved GGQ motif, as it's called, for those three amino acids, that mimics the CCA acceptor stem where there would be an amino acid, but this portion instead presumably interacts with the ribosomal RNA, and so there are other groups studying these protein-RNA interactions. And so I think we'll know a lot more about the mechanism, at least of not only translation, but in this case, termination in a few years. It's essentially accompanied all the knowledge that we have now about the structure of the ribosome to study all these different proteins involved in translation.
Is termination
required? I think not, but I'm not sure. It might be actually most of these, like translocation, involved GTP. I don't know if termination requires either. So the approach that I'll briefly describe here was a really straightforward one. We downloaded all the sequences that were available for ERF1 proteins, eukaryotic release factor ones, in GenBank. And in addition, Kathy Lozapone in my lab sequenced the ERF1 protein in a cluster of ciliate species that also used variant genetic codes. And then we looked at the amino acid sequence alignments, especially in domain 1 of this protein, to see if we could identify residues that change specifically in those lineages that had different genetic codes. So a red highlighted residue indicates an amino acid residue that changed in a lineage that uses UAR for glutamine, and yellow indicates a lineage that uses a change in UGA as sense. And in this case, since we're studying the release factor, it doesn't matter if UGA is being used as tryptophan or as cysteine. Essentially, this is equivalent to what a geneticist would call suppression of termination by stop codons. So we're looking at UGA suppression or UAR suppression. And what's shown above the amino acid sequence alignment are in fact mutations that another lab, Ian Stansfield in the UK, identified as places where the genes mutate in a mutant suppressor screen to create UGA or UAR suppressors. So what we're finding, first of all, is strong correlations between those residues which in directed evolution experiments in the laboratory change in order to affect translational suppression, which is equivalent to the change of a genetic code, and nature's experiments, which are those residues that change specifically in lineages that also have changes in the genetic code. I'll just add that the orange residue highlighted over here is one instance of one of those conserved tryptophans I showed you in an alignment earlier that occurs, that's encoded by a UGA and occurs at the position of a reasonably conserved tryptophan. So first of all, what's striking is that there are these clusters of residues that change, sometimes even to the same identity, for example, to a valine or to, over here we have N, it's a little hard to see, L, S, and there's another example in here, phenylalanine, residues that change to the same identical residue independently in those lineages that use the same genetic code. So the three species I've talked about, Stylonychia and Octetricha, up here, and then there's also Tetrahymena, a very distantly divergent species that uses the same UAR for glutamine code. Again, here we have independent evolution in Euploides and in Blepharisma to UGA-suppressing genetic codes that use a UGA for sense codon instead of UGA as stop. And we see, again, striking examples such as this one here, where there's convergent evolution at the molecular level to the same residue. For example, leucine changing to an isoleucine in those lineages that read UGA as sense, and the leucine changing to a phenylalanine in lineages that use UAR as sense.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was thinking back to that slide where you mentioned that there was some controversy whether there's been one change and then a number of reverse changes back, and or whether these things have happened independently. And it seemed, just glancing at it, that both of those ideas were equally parsimonious, that if you imagine a change back is as likely as a change forward, they seem to be within the noise of no way to support one or the other.
And so the fact that it requires so few changes to affect a rewiring in the genetic code suggests that here's plausibly why it might be possible to go back and forth between different genetic codes. But bear in mind that all the protein coding sequences have to also change their stop codons. So there's a lot of change required at the whole level of the entire genome in order to accompany a change if it becomes fixed in the release factor sequences.
Yeah, but that's true whether you're going back and forth or only independently forth. But the fact that you're getting what looks like convergent evolution, that would seem to be, the other explanation is that it supports the that there was one change that was then reversed a number of times model. That these are not independent events, but they happen once.
Right. But also keep in mind that if a change occurs from a standard genetic code background to one of these restricted codes, then a third or two-thirds of those protein coding sequences wouldn't have to change because they'd already have compatible stop codons. So there are a couple more comments I want to make about this slide. First of all, what we're scoring and highlighting here are residues that change, not necessarily residues that change to the same residue, that change to the same meaning, that is, but they change specifically in lineages with variant codes. So those are the residues that are highlighted in this slide. It's striking, in addition, that there are more residues that change specifically in those lineages with the UAR as glutamine codes than there are yellow residues, ones that change to affect a UGA as sense code. And this is in agreement, again, with a result that bacterial geneticists have known for a long time, which is that it's easier to affect UGA suppression than to get UAR suppression in a mutant lab screen. And this suggests, in general, that there might be more capacity to create genetic codes that reassign the UGA stop codon than that reassign the UAR codon, or UAR codons plural. Now, I highlighted the specific residue and told you a little bit about position 123 in this amino acid alignment. It's striking, for example, that there's precise agreement with the change in leucine to isoleucine or leucine to phenylalanine associated with the change in the meaning of those two genetic codes. Now, that position 123 in that alignment corresponds to position 126 in the human sequence. And what you see here is a composite of the residues that change in those lineages that were highlighted in the previous slide, superimposed on the residues, or highlighting the residues in the crystal structure of the human protein. So yellow are those residues in the human release factor 1 protein that change specifically in UGA as sense codes. Red are the ensemble of changes that occur in the UAR as sense codes, and orange are the ones that change in both. Now, in a model for how the release factor 1 protein interacts with the anticodon, there's no crystal structure yet of, say, a co-structure of this protein bound to the anticodon in the ribosome, which is what would be needed next. What you have essentially is the second position of the anticodon snugly fitting into this hydrophobic pocket, which could explain why a change as subtle as leucine to isoleucine would permit recognition of a restricted set of stop codons here, for example. So those are clearly two important residues, although so far that's just a model, again, from Stansfield's labs and from others who are studying the release factor 1. And lastly, the one thing I'll tell you about is another approach to looking at molecular correlates of evolutionary change and how we also honed in on certain residues in the ERF1 protein to study. And that was that Rob Knight in my lab, whose work I've talked about quite a fair bit, developed a statistical tool to create a sliding window analysis of the ERF1 protein sequence that would look for windows of correlation between change in the genetic code with change in the amino acid identity in that region, or an amino acid within that 5-base window. And the window size can change, and this is something that's available on our website, the URLs in the current biology paper that describe this work, which is a way of looking at across the protein, because you wouldn't have statistical significance if you looked at a window size of 1, to identify certain residues or regions of the protein that strongly associate with changes both in the meaning of the genetic code and changes in the protein. So what you see here is a superposition of several of those graphs that you saw on the previous slide. And this identifies basically 4 peaks that were stable to all window sizes across the protein that correlate well between having changes in the protein sequence that correlate with changes in the changes in the genetic code. So the regions I've talked about so far are these two peaks, which correspond to domain 1. But I'll simply add that there are other regions of the protein that presumably have to co-evolve with the ribosomal RNA, such that they also have changes. This part over here, I believe, corresponds to what I was referring to as the GGQ motif in this protein, which mimics the CCA acceptor stem and is the part that probably interacts with the ribosome to terminate the nascent peptide. Well, okay, here we're scanning across the protein sequence, and it's constructing for each window a 2x2 table that, in the same way I described yesterday, for example, for looking at arginine, whether or not a nucleotide falls into a codon and falls into a binding site. Here we're looking at whether this window changes in the genetic code and changes in amino acid residues. Okay, so we're seeing it's simply a g-test for correlation, like a chi-squared, to ask whether or not the residue has, or the residues in that window do change, and then whether or not the genetic code changes. Okay, and then this is normalized over on the left.
There's a lot of hazards in this type of analysis in terms of the fact that the evolutionary pattern itself induces all sorts of correlations. In other words, that you would expect just as a result of the trait. So,
right.
So the idea of looking at correlations like this makes me a little bit nervous.
Well, it makes me less nervous when you combine this with the sort of more clear-cut way of looking at the data, which is once we identified certain regions, we go back and scan them with the famous ivalometer and notice that, well, it's clear that there are these leucine to isoleucine changes that happen in one case and leucine to phenylalanine changes that happen in another case. That's what this is picking up, because those changes would happen over here. Right, but if you had a much larger data set, then this is a way of homing in on certain parts of the protein alignment rather than staring at it manually the entire time.
Right. But what I'm saying is that the same correlations induced by phylogenetics, which would appear as a false correlation in a statistical study like this, would also appear as a false correlation when you eyeball it.
Right, very, very good point. Thanks for mentioning that. So, in fact, those residues that change convergently, of which there were five. So this analysis is contingent on having an evolutionary tree, because it's done per, if you look at a branch of the evolutionary tree, we're asking whether a change occurs on that branch in the genetic code, and whether a change occurs on that branch in the amino acid residue identity. So it's contingent on having a reasonable phylogenetic tree, which we only got if we took out the five residues that were convergently evolving. So it requires some knowledge of what the tree should look like on the basis of other sequences.
But it also then is depending upon the correct placement of the particular events involved in when the genetic code changes. In other words, in order to make that correlation, you have to say, I believe the change in the genetic code occurred here rather than here.
Yes. So those data should be inferred from other studies, and so that it's independent of this study. Okay. Okay, so lastly, this is the last pretty slide I have to show. This is sort of the reminder of how much is not known, or how much exists in this unseen world. For example, in these two ciliates, which are relatives of those species I've showed you, we don't know anything about the mechanisms or map orders of the genes within these species, tintinnines, for example, on the left. And we also know nothing about their genetic codes and genetic code usage within these species. So it's sort of a call to arms and a wake-up call to bear in mind how little we know, in fact, about the microbial eukaryotic world, whether it's at the level of gene organization or as fundamental as the genetic code. And these are the people who have been involved in the work I've talked about today. Gene rearrangements has been a series of collaborations with postdocs who are listed at the top, who did a lot of the gene sequence analysis and annotation, and a slew of undergraduates, and another postdoc, David Ardell, who's interested in bioinformatic aspects of the splice genes and the pointers. And we've received ciliate samples from a variety of collaborators, including Hans Lips and David Prescott and Klaus Heckmann. Leela Carey is a computer scientist at the University of Western Ontario, with whom I've done some modeling of this system that I mentioned at the beginning of the second half. And the work on the genetic code I talked about today was done as a collaboration with Rob Knight, a grad student in my lab, who took that statistical approach at the end, and Kathy Lozapone, who did all the sequencing and the data mining of ciliate ERF1 and other protein coding sequences. And the work I described on RNA editing was all from one graduate student, Tam Horton. So thanks very much.